Hello and good morning to Studies Through the Bible with Pastor Zach Ebarb. I am Pastor Zach. Of course, today we are going to continue our study through the book of Genesis. For any of our new listeners that are coming on, just kind of let everybody know there's been some questions back and forth about when we start and whatnot. I am Central Time Zone, so I start at 10 o'clock my time, Central Time Zone. If you're in before me, then it may be later in the day. If you're after me, then it may be a little bit different for you then. But that's when we start, Central Time Zone, 10 a.m. Just try to find out when that is for your time clock, and then you can make sure to be here on time for it and whatnot. Nobody will be coming in late. I had a few people ask questions about that. But so we are continuing to look at the book of Genesis. So now, of course, we have covered the first eight chapters, and a lot of things have happened within these first eight chapters. We've seen the creation of the world, creation of Adam and Eve. And of course, we've talked about that there is an undisclosed amount of time that takes place in there, that the necessity for documenting time, of course, is not necessary. It does not begin until death becomes a landmark in life. So we don't know really how much time surpassed by the time man finally fell, but we have seen the creation, the undisclosed amount of time that occurs there. We know that the world had age built into it by God naturally. And then, of course, we see by chapter 3, the fall of men with the sin of Adam and Eve and the deception of Satan. And from there, we moved into how there were these different generations that come from Adam and Eve, specifically discussing Cain and Abel. We know that Cain, of course, murders Abel. And then we have the bloodline of Cain, the bloodline of Seth. And then we got into the very controversial chapter about who are these giants? Who are these sons of God that sleep with these daughters of men? And I, of course, gave you my educated opinion, my educated belief on it, being that this is, of course, the line of Seth mingling with the line of Cain. It only makes sense that we talk about those two lines and then talk about those two lines coming together, which would have brought about the evil that was going on in the world. Some people think that they're angels and they try to base that off of Jude. There's a lot of things with that. I would say that you're getting into some murky water if you try to use that to justify what's going on in chapter 5 and 6 there, and 7. But well, then after that, of course, we got into chapter 7, chapter 8. Noah finds grace in the eyes of the Lord. We see all the evil mankind has surpassed. And now by chapter 9, we're getting off the boat, right? We've had the flood. All these things have happened. A whole calendar year has passed. It says here, "And God blessed Noah and his sons and said unto them, Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth, and upon every fowl of the air, upon all that moveth upon the earth, and upon all the fishes of the sea. Into your hand are they delivered. Every moving thing that liveth shall be meat for you. Even as the green herb have I given you all things. But flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, shall ye not eat. And surely the blood, your blood of your lives will I require. At the hand of every beast will I require it, and at the hand of man. At the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of man. Whoso sheddeth man's blood by man, shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man. And you, be ye fruitful and multiply, bring forth abundantly in the earth, and multiply therein." Okay, so we have gotten off the boat, everybody has gone away, and now God gives these last commandments to mankind before he establishes his covenant with Noah, which of course we know is that the world will never be flooded again. And there's a couple of very interesting things here. Obviously, we see a repetition of be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. A lot of people have taken this verse extremely out of context, and they think that means God's people are supposed to have as many children as they possibly can. No, that is not at all what this means. Children are a blessing. Yes, I have one daughter. I promise you, I don't need but one, okay? For many other people, you may want 3, 4, 5, whatever. That's okay. But if you're basing your entire system of having children or how many you have off of this area of the Bible, I need to inform you that there were only at this particular time 8 human beings on the earth. It was necessity that they be fruitful and multiply, or there would not be any more humans and there would not be any more animals. So the whole basis for this, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth, is, hey, we're running out of people. You guys are going to have to get to work on restoring everything back to how it was. Understand that the world has gone through a massive, massive ecological atmospheric change. There are but just a couple of groups of animals and people left, and we have to fill up the entire earth. It's not just that we're trying to fill up the location where we are. We have to fill up the entire earth. So it was necessary that they go about doing this. And not only that, but there's a little bit simpler times as far as having children go. Today, you want to have a baby, I promise you, $5,000 to $10,000 is what you're going to put down on a baby. If you're like me and my wife, we had a double deductible. We got the $10,000 number, okay? There's some responsibility that needs to come into play. Do not just take this verse and go buck wild with it. This was a different time and a different situation that was carrying on here in Genesis. And then there's a very interesting commandment that's given here. It says, and the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth, and upon every fowl of the air, upon all that moveth upon the earth, and upon all the fishes of the sea. Into your hand are they delivered. Every moving thing that liveth shall be meat for you. Even as the green herb have I given you all things. So we have a new commandment coming off of the ark. Now, I cannot tell you whether or not this was true, but there is a common belief that it was not until after the ark that men begin to eat animals because of this verse. Okay. And remember, there was a different relationship prior to the ark, not only with man and animals, but also with the atmosphere and how the world was weather-wise. There was a lot of drastic things, including how long people lived, that was very different before and after the flood. So here, regardless of whether or not the indicator is that now for the first time ever, men are going to eat meat, or whether they had already before and God's just giving this commandment, is regardless of whether or not that's the case. The point of this is that the natural fear of creation towards mankind was given because of the fact that we were able to eat them. Okay. I think this is kind of funny because I do a lot of deer hunting. I do a lot of fishing. And there's this huge ethical debate in the hunting and fishing community about whether or not that we are taking advantage over an animal. And that's why all the rules and laws are in place, because there's a lot of people that, you know, you set up a deer feeder and you go out there, and if you see, go and visit Bambi every day and you're feeding Bambi, eventually Bambi's basically your pet, even though he's running 80 or 90 acres and you don't have him on the chain. And so the idea here is that God is giving animals a natural instinctual desire to flee man, so that there is a fairness about this eating of animals, okay? Kind of gives them a little bit of a hand. Not only that, but also we know that God said the earth would rise up against us, that we would work very, very hard for our food, when we would get but enough to survive, was basically the idea given in Genesis chapter 3. And then, of course, there is another very important thing that comes into this idea of fear. Fear plays a very large role in domestication of an animal. They have a natural fear of humans, and if humans have control over that animal, they're going to do what is desired of them from that placement of fear. Now, of course, many of you go, well, now, wait a minute, Brother Zach, I have a dog and we love each other and he trusts me and da 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 da. Yeah, okay. Yes, I understand that. Your relationship has blossomed over the years. Congratulations. Before that, though, what was that dog's natural reaction to you, especially if you just found that dog? He was a stray dog, okay? There was fear that came with it. You had to coax that fear into a trust, and it's no different with any other animal. That nature of fear is what brings about a desire to do command too. If you have a dog and he knows that if he bites somebody, you're going to spank him, he stops himself from biting out of fear for what you will do to his hind parts, okay? So what we have here is a establishment not only of equaling the playing field out for creation, but we also have an establishment of a relationship that has the potential to become domestication. And some people may disagree with that. That's okay. If you loved an animal into loving you, fabulous. If you had to spank your dog, I don't care either way. Okay. Whatever it takes to keep your dog from biting somebody, I'm on board with. Now, so we have this be fruitful and multiply. And then we also have this idea that fear has been given into animals and animals have been given over to man to eat of freely. There is no this concept of clean and unclean. While it was mentioned going into the ark, it was mentioned in the sense that God was preparing people for what was to come. The actual rules about what you can and cannot eat that comes with Levitical law have not been established at this point yet. But there is one very important rule that plays a major role in Levitical law that is introduced here. But flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, shall ye not eat. And surely your blood of your lives will I require. At the hand of every beast will I require it, and at the hand of man. And at the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of man. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God made he man. And you be fruitful and multiply and bring forth abundantly in the earth and multiply therein. So now we have the final peg in God's commandments to mankind. We were, of course, commanded to be fruitful, multiply, replenish the earth because we had a very, very few people. We are told that we can eat of any of the animals, and reason for that being that the earth has taken a major toll. There is not a lot of available food sources. Therefore, the animals got put on the menu also. And then we see something that is so highly debated by pretty much everybody in this world, that if a man or a beast kills a human being, okay? And that idea of take a life means to murder. Whosoever sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. Whether we like to admit it or not, whether we want to have the discussion or not, whether you like it or not, reality is that in Genesis chapter 9, capital punishment for murder is fully established. And not just capital punishment. The idea is that anyone who murders a human being, beast or man, shall also be killed by man. And this is evident in a lot of very different ways. First of all, obviously, this comes into play with capital punishment. If a man commits murder, he's taken to court, he is found guilty of that murder, what naturally is supposed to follow is the death penalty. Now, I know that doesn't occur today, and I would say look at our society versus society in the time of Sodom and Gomorrah when this did not exist too, and you might begin to put some puzzle pieces together on why God brought this into being, okay? Because we have this idea that we can rehabilitate people who are murderers, and I am here to tell you that once you have killed something, it gets easier every time. When I was a child, now I've never murdered anybody for anybody that's getting nervous on here, but when I first began hunting and I killed my very first deer, I about had an emotional breakdown. Okay, I'm sharing something very personal with all of you here, all right? At 10 years old, I about cried because I had killed that deer. I am now a 24-year-old man, and when I shoot a deer, I am absolutely ecstatic. Why? Because the initial feelings, the initial guilt, the initial, oh no, I just killed Bambi at 10 years old, is no longer gone. As an adult, I'm like, no, this is what we do to eat food. I bring the whole thing home. Every single bit of that thing gets used. Nothing goes to waste. But as a 10-year-old, that was a hard thing. There was a realization that what I had just done is I had, with my own hand, taken the life, even though it was just the life of a soulless animal. And that realization brought about some major guilt. Now I'm telling you at 24 and 10 more deer in, it doesn't bother me one bit. I do it. I go down. I'm like, fabulous. We got him. He's a nice sized deer. He'll make lots of food. And I get right to work. I'm doing what I need to do. Okay. So the idea of rehabilitating a murder is few and far between. There may be a rough 5-6% of people who commit murder that have a major regret, a major guilt, and get their life together. But reality is that once you have taken a life, especially once you have crossed the line over into taking a human life, there is an issue here of it becomes easier for many people. So when we're looking at Genesis chapter 9, and God says, for anyone who sheds man's blood, I require blood again. The purpose for this is that so we do not go back to the days of Sodom and Gomorrah. Remember, when we are looking at Genesis chapter 6, every man's doing whatever they want to do. We have Lamech, who is one of Canaan's great-great-grandkids, who is singing a song about how he had murdered a man. And he sings it to his wives. And he's proud of it. This man wounded me. He did me wrong. But guess what? I killed him. Friends, the reality of the situation is that this commandment of if anyone, man or beast, murders, sheds the blood of a human being, they are to be killed by man, has a well-founded principle, and it's because there is a level of hatred. There's a level of crossing a line that comes with taking a life, and whether we want to admit it or not, when we don't deal with that the way that it is supposed to be dealt with, when we don't deal with that in the fullness of what has occurred, then you are just opening the door for more people to commit this same act later on. This is no different than if your child does something wrong, you need to discipline your child in accordance with whatever action they committed. Because if you don't, what are they going to do tomorrow? The exact same thing. Okay, that's no different. If somebody murdered somebody today, you let them out of prison in 5 years. 5 years is nothing. You've told them that another human life amounts to a whopping 5 years in jail, where they get 3 square meals a day and they watch TV and they work out and they do nothing for 5 years but play around all day. There has to be immediate action. God understood this here. He said the only way to maintain this, to keep this from getting to the point it was before the flood, for the reason for the flood, is that if any of you kill a man, I require the life of that man or that animal. Whosoever sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. But why? For in the image of God made he man. When we take another person's life into our own hands in a murderous way, okay, there's a difference between accidentally killing somebody. There's a difference between war. We would get into areas of just war, because I know there's some veterans and soldiers that struggle with what they had to do over there. When you're in a self-defense situation, you have to do what you have to do, whether you like it or don't like it. There's a lot of differences between killing a man, killing a person, and murdering a person. When you murder somebody, when you shed man's blood intentionally for your own selfish, hateful reasons, you have compromised the image of God in man. Every human being, black, yellow, purple, pink, white, whatever, whatever color you want to pick, olive skin tone, whatever, every single human being on the planet is made in the image of God. They are a three-part being. To murder them is inherently evil on a plane that even God calls for the death of that individual. There is no if then, or you know, exception to the rule, if someone commits murder, then God calls for that person to be executed. There's no other way around it. So we see these four very important rules coming off the ark. God says to be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. And of course, he gives this twice to indicate the necessity of these people going back and multiplying and making sure we fill the earth up, because we have Noah and his wife, his three children, and their wives. That's all we've got coming off the ark. We see that God says, you can eat of every animal. And I have instilled fear in animals, and of course that is to kind of level the playing field to a degree. There is a different relationship between man and creation before and after the ark. And then we see the very important rule established of murder is wrong, 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 to the point. The seriousness of it is that if somebody commits this, or even if an animal commits this, I require the blood of whoever has done it or whatever has done it. And then God moves into a very beautiful part of chapter 9. He says, and God spake unto Noah and to his sons with him, saying, and I, behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your seed after you, and with every living creature that is with you, of the fowl, of the cattle, and of every beast of the earth with you, from all that go out of the ark to every beast of the earth. And I will establish my covenant with you. Neither shall all flesh be cut off any more by the waters of a flood, neither shall there be any more a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is the token of the covenant which I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations. I do set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be for a token of a covenant between me and the earth. And it shall come to pass when I bring a cloud over the earth that the bow shall be seen in the cloud, and I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. And the water shall no more become a flood to destroy all flesh. And the bow shall be in the cloud, and I will look upon it that I may remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is upon the earth. And God said unto Noah, this is the token of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is upon the earth. So coming off the ark, we have an establishment, a beginning of an establishment of rules and laws. Every man's built with a moral compass. We understand stealing's wrong, adultery's wrong, murder's wrong. You could go to anybody on the street today, and I think they would all agree with you on basic morality, okay, this moral compass. God begins to build some more rules into that. We see here of not eating of blood. We see that there are nature of a relationship between man and creation is going to drastically change. We've been given this commandment to be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. There's some beginnings of a structural understanding that by the time we get to Leviticus, we can usher in the law. And God begins building that in Genesis. But one of the best ways that God builds his relationship with his people, something you are going to see with every single patriarch of the Bible, okay, is a covenant. Now, when we begin to think of a covenant, that is more than the idea of what you and I would call a promise. For example, that word has changed drastically today. It gets thrown around quite a bit. Oh, well, I promise you, I'll do such and such. Now, we may try our absolute best to fulfill that, but sometimes we fall short of that, mostly because we're human and life happens, okay? But with God, this idea of a covenant, of a promise, there's no exception. It means that this is going to be an eternal agreement. We even find out that the picture of this idea of a covenant with Abraham, we see that God says, you're going to take these four animals, you're going to cut them in half, and I'm going to pass in the midst thereof. The idea of a covenant with God is, if I fail to keep this agreement, this promise, this contract, if you will, okay? If I fail to keep this, let me be sown in half like these animals. That's the picture in the Old Testament of what a covenant is. Here, God gives a covenant, though, that is unlike any of the others in the Bible. If you go and look at the covenants that he makes with Abraham, there are contingencies, right? If you do this, then I will do this. For Abraham, it was, if you will abide in Canaan and serve me, then I will bless you abundantly, right? For Moses, it was, if the people will obey, then I will bless them and I will give them this land. We see that they broke that. They get to Kadesh Barnea and they go, oh no, we can't do it, God. I'm so sorry. And God says, okay, fine. You get to wander around the wilderness for 40 years and your kids will get to go in and do what you didn't have the faith to do yourself. But here, there's no, if you do, then I will not. The very first covenant God makes with mankind is given completely free. God says, I promise I will not ever destroy all of creation. It's not just with mankind, it's with the entirety of creation. I will never again destroy the earth by a flood. Now, some people get this and they go, oh, well, God realized he was too harsh. No, that's not the idea here. The idea here is that there is going to come a time, okay, where the world is going to be destroyed by fire. And secondly, remember that the world that we know after the ark is nothing like the world that came before it. God has literally reset the stage completely. We've had a change in land, we've had a change in life. We've got an interesting situation of how these animals are going to reproduce and try to fill back up the earth. We have a difference in relationship between animals and mankind. We have a major change in ecology and the atmosphere of the world. There are so many things that God has put a reset button on and then changed the game on that it would not be necessary again for God to destroy the world by a flood. It was not going to be necessary because there was no way mankind was going to be able to get to that point again as quickly as they had before the flood. Remember, you've got people living 800, 900 years. If you're an evil, wicked individual and you've got 900 years of life, you can accomplish a lot of sin in that time frame, okay? But now after the flood, we know that the lifespans of man diminish tremendously. If you see somebody today that lived to be 120 years old, you're like, oh my goodness, how in the world did he make it that long? Even with modern medicine, the life expectancy of people is in the 70 to 80 range. You start getting up around late 80s and everybody's like, oh wow, really? 88, 89? Wow. There's just not that much lifetime anymore for mankind, which means man doesn't have the ability to sin and to build up as much evil behavior in the one lifetime as they were before, where they're living 700, 800, 900 years. So this covenant is not just a promise to the world of you don't have to worry about this again, but it was also because there was not going to be a necessity for it. God wanted to show them, the punishment has come, the punishment is done. Here's my agreement with you that this will never happen again. And he gives a beautiful sign, right? He gives a rainbow. Now that has been taken and warped tremendously in modern culture. Why in the world we've allowed that to happen, I don't know. But the picture of that rainbow was not only symbolic of the fact that God was not going to flood the world again, but the possibility, the potential for a rainbow to come about only came as a result of God changing the atmosphere. Remember, we talked about before that the water was not only locked up and sealed in the ground, but we had a perfect covering that when he talks about the firmament, right up there in the air, we had a perfect water covering that would have made for an atmosphere that did not need rain, that would have been perfect without rain. And you can go back to Genesis chapter 1 to hear all the science that goes into that. I'm not going to try to divulge into that on this podcast. But the reason when God broke that firmament, we have all the water pour out of the atmosphere to the ground, and then the water bubble up and bust out from underneath the earth and those reservoirs beneath the earth to cause this major flood. When that firmament was broken, we started what we now modernly know as the water cycle. So this a covenant mark, this rainbow, not only was a beautiful sign of that promise, but it was only made, given the ability to be shown and made by what God had done through the flood. It was a marker of not only will I not ever do this, but the, even the possibility for this sign to be shown to you, we had to have the flood. It's a beautiful, beautiful reminder. All the way, even today, after it rains, you step out, boom, there's a rainbow every single time. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. It's a beautiful reminder that even though this agreement happened thousands and thousands of years ago, God is still maintaining this covenant with creation on a basis that is strictly of his own love for his creation. It wasn't, if man will do right, then I'll do this. It was, no, I love creation. I love what I've made. I love all of you. This is a sign that I will never again do this again. Now, we know that there's coming a day when things are going to get heated up, things are going to get ugly. If you go read Revelations and you can try to divulge some of that for yourself, go ahead. There's going to come a time where the world's going to have to be destroyed and redone. We know that. But the fact that God, even through all these thousands of years, even through all the evil that mankind has done since this moment, has maintained that promise and given that sign over and over and over and over and over again, shows just how much God truly cares and loves his creation. Coming off the ark, he disciplines them. He gives them these rules. He starts to build up the necessary path to establish his law. He makes a covenant agreement where they would not have to be concerned about something like this happened again, and he seals it with a sign. And you would think, okay, you would think, after all of this, after God showing his love, after God giving guidance, giving ability to take care of oneself by even saying, yes, you can eat of the animals and whatever animal you want, you can eat of it. You would think that we would have learned, that we would have said, wow, God loves us so much, we need to do the right thing when we get off this boat and get to work on what God has told us to get to work on. You would think that would be the natural result of what God does here. But instead, what do you think mankind is already up to again? Oh, back to our old ways. It says, and the sons of Noah that went forth of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And Ham is the father of Canaan. Now, next week, we are going to discuss what they call the table of generations, okay? That's the fancy way for calling Genesis chapter 10 how in the world everybody you know to be has come to be, okay? So we're not going to go very, very in-depth about this Shem, Ham, Japheth, and Ham being the father of Canaan discussion this week, okay? So if you're, by the time we get done with this, you go, well, wait a minute now, he didn't go into this whole Canaan and curse and all this in a deeper format. That's the reason, because this is going to tie much more in with chapter 10, what's going to come with the curse of Canaan, than it ties in with what we're talking about today in chapter 9. And so, it says, these are the three sons of Noah, and of them was the whole earth overspread. So we see God give man guidance on what they can and cannot do, what the beginning of laws and rules are going to be when we start to see an established human government, something else that hasn't really existed before now, okay, and won't really exist until a lot further down the line. Even here, we don't have a full human government. We just have, if someone murders, they need to be executed. That's all we got, okay? But also, we see the love and the promise of God. And now we are being informed, we kind of have what seems like a weird shift in the story. That, all right, so Noah's got these three kids, remember these guys. Ham is the father of Canaan. I'll explain why that's important in just a moment. It's kind of what our writer's telling you. That's how Hebrews like to talk and how they like to write. It says, and these three sons are the ones who are responsible for the entire filling of the earth. Okay, everybody comes out of these three guys. And Noah began to be an husbandman, which means he was a farmer, all right? And he planted a vineyard. Okay, so as a farmer, there's probably more to this than just he planted a vineyard. I'm sure he had all kinds of vegetables and things of that nature that he planted too to help sustain his family. But the big thing they want you to focus on is that he plants a vineyard, all right? And he drank of the wine and was drunken, and he was uncovered within his tent. Okay, this is where things are going to get sticky. I told all of you, chapter 9 of Genesis is a very controversial chapter. Some people get very extreme on whatever view they want to have of this, and then there's people like me that go, regardless of which of these potentials occurred, what happened was mankind being wicked, evil, and sinful yet again. Now, already right off the bat, here we go. Noah's off the boat. He becomes a farmer, he makes a vineyard, and he gets drunk. Okay. All of you, for many of you that have been listening to this for a while now, you know my view on alcohol. My view on alcohol is that it is biblically wrong. I believe that can be proven from many, many standpoints. One of those being the fact we are commanded a multiplicity of times in the Word of God that we are not to be drunken. Now, I'm going to tell y'all a little something about this concept of being drunk. There is nobody on the planet that has a set ability to know when or when they are not drunk. I was raised in a household with an alcoholic father. He could drink all the whim long day and never be drunk. But I've also seen other people that if you gave them a sip of an alcoholic beverage, they would not know their name. That very concept of we are not supposed to be drunken, that we are not supposed to be drunk, that we are commanded to not be drunk, already tells me alcohol is not something we're supposed to partake in or be around. And for a part of that, we already see here, he is drunk and what? Naked in his tent. He's making a fool of himself. This is the man of God who built the ark, who brought the last of humanity off of the ark, who brought the last of the animals and a new beginning off of the ark, and he's not here for another 10, 15 years, and he's drunk and naked in his tent, acting a fool. Friends, I'm going to tell you right now, alcohol is not something any believer of God should be even considering looking at for a multiplicity of reasons beyond just the foolishness of that behavior. It is a depressant drug. It is made to make your judgment poorer. It is made to make you looser. It is made to make you not have any cognitive function whatsoever and not determine risks and consequences of your actions. Go sit outside a bar and watch the people that go in and how they come out. And I can tell you right now, it's not something God's people are supposed to be partaking in. And that's not even getting into the discussion of we are supposed to stay away from the sight of evil. Okay? And we will talk more about this alcohol concept as we are going through the Bible because I believe this is one of the biggest things that Satan has fooled God's people into thinking that they can get away with, and it has led to a lot of horrible decisions amongst God's people. But so Noah here, he gets drunk off his vineyard and he is naked in his tent. This is where things get sticky. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brethren without. Okay. In Hebrew language, there are some very interesting words. Some words can seem like they are a noun, but they have a verb use. Okay. And when we are looking at those words, that there sometimes comes a point and a place where, unless you were a Hebrew in this day and time, you cannot pinpoint exactly what the idea was behind this word. So let me tell you the two ways that this can be looked at, all right? And then I will tell you what my personal opinion and belief is based off of the context and what happens later on, okay? you can see this as simply how it reads in English, which is not a very good translation of what is said in Hebrew, but it's good enough to get across the concept. Okay. Ham comes into the tent, sees his father naked, and goes and tells his two brethren without. Now, there is one part of this everybody agrees on. Here, when it says, and told his two brethren without, the word that is used in Hebrew here means that he told with delight. Okay? It's the idea that he thought it was hilarious, he thought it was great, and he goes and tells his two brothers. All right? Now, if I tell you that, you're going to automatically assume the first idea. And the first idea is that Ham comes in, sees Noah passed out drunk in his tent, naked, comes out, laughs, makes fun of his father to his two brothers. Okay? But there are other people, and they're not, you can't really argue with them to some degree on what's going on here either. There are some people, though, that understand the concept here and look at this word of he came in and he saw the nakedness of his father. There are times that that phrase, saw the nakedness, indicates verbal action. And when I say verbal action, I don't mean as in auditory, but as in a verb, the action of a verb, okay? Meaning that there is a good likely chance that Ham also raped his father, took advantage of his father in his drunken state. Now, let me tell you what I think about this. I will tell you that I think that it is more than likely that he took sexual advantage of his father. Don't know to what degree that was. Don't really want to think about to what degree that was. The reason for that is because of what is said in verse 24. It says, and Noah awoke from his wine, which means he comes out of this drunken stupor, he starts to sober up, and knew what his younger son had done unto him. The idea of had done unto him indicates action also. If I woke up from a drunken stupor, God forbid, but if I woke up from a drunken stupor and my young daughter had seen me in it, I would not know coming sobering up that she had saw me and made fun of me to her mother or the church members or whatever, okay? But I would know sobering up and coming out of a drunken stupor if I had been physically, sexually molested in some form or fashion. That is something that you know the moment you wake up. You don't have to have somebody come tell you, hey, you were raped. All right. There's nobody in the book that has ever had this happen that has never woke up and remembered something happened to them. They may not know faces, names, details, but they know based off of their body and what they can put together from that drunken stupor that something had occurred. There's no way in the world Noah would have sobered up and said, I know Ham came in here and then went out and made fun of me to you guys. Okay? The idea here that is presented, as well as with the curse that Noah's going to give later on here, gives the idea that Ham took sexual advantage of Noah. Now, you can agree with that or not agree with it, doesn't matter. If you want to go with no, he just made fun of him. Either way, he dishonored his father. As to the extremity of how that has underwent, I will leave for you to decide for yourself. It doesn't change the point of what happens here. What happens here is that Noah commits a sin that it dishonors himself and leads to further sinning on the part of his son who either makes fun of him or who has taken sexual advantage of him. And Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it upon both their shoulders and went backward and covered the nakedness of their father, and their faces were backward, and they saw not their father's nakedness. He comes out laughing, joking, either about what he has done or about what he has seen. Okay? And Shem and Japheth ignore him, get a garment, and they literally walk backwards into the tent, cover him up, and then come back out so that they do not see him. They do everything in their power to try and honor their father and to not partake in making this situation any worse than it already is. And when Noah, of course, wakes up from this, we already see that it says, and he said, cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren. And he said, blessed be the Lord God of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. God shall enlarge Japheth, and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. And Noah lived after the flood 350 years, and all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. So he awakes out of this stupor, and this is another reason why I think it was more of the physical action, because the moment he comes out, he declares this prophecy about Ham's son Canaan. Now, there are a lot of people that jump on this part of the Bible and they go, oh, see, God is unfair. The son's paying for the sins of the father. No, that is not the case here. That is not the idea of what's going on here, and that is not what Noah is deeming to be happening, okay? Let me paint you a picture, all right? If Ham came out and made fun of his father for being drunk and naked in his tent, or if Ham raped his father and came out and delighted and laughed and joked about it out of his tent, what kind of a man do and we all agree that this individual probably is? An evil one. Either way, this is not, if I came in and found my father in such an inappropriate state, I would not be coming out and joking. I'd be doing everything I could possibly do to get him covered back up and to pretend it never happened, okay? I would not be coming out and going, ha ha, look at Dad back there. He had a naked as a jaybird, drunk off his hind end. Fabulous. That is not at all what any good moral man would think about or do to another individual in this state, whether making fun of or taking physical advantage of, okay? If this is the kind of man that is raising Canaan, what kind of man do you think Canaan is going to be? Just like his father. Guys, one of the funniest things about humanity that you learn as you further go on and go on in life is that you spend your whole life as a child saying, I'll never do like mom and dad. And then before you know it, you're married, you have a child, and you catch yourself saying the exact same nonsense they said to you as a child. And you go, oh my goodness, I have become my parents. Why is it that that happens? Because you were raised by those individuals. The values, the beliefs, all the things that they had, they bestowed into you as a child. Now, to some degree, if you are a follower of God, a child of God, then you should be instilling and removing anything that should not be that been put in there and throwing it out the door, and filling it up with God and further building on the principles that were instilled that God desires and wants in you. I'm not saying that it's impossible for you to change as you grow up. It is possible through the power of God. But if this is the kind of man Ham already is, he's raising Canaan. What do you think is the likelihood that Canaan is going to hear about and learn about the power of God from Ham? He's not. And we know later on that Canaan becomes the founding father, for lack of a better way of putting it, of a lot of the majority of the Canaanite cultures that are in Canaan that Moses and the Israelites are later told to go in and destroy. And we see what they bred with all of that. We have idolatry. There's some of the worst kinds. We will talk about Molech. We will talk about Dagon and some of these different gods that come into place with this idolatry. And I'm going to give you the full picture of what those gods are, all right? I'm not one of those people that sugarcoats the whole idolatry thing. I will make sure you understand exactly what took place with these people, especially Molech. That's one of the worst things that the man could have ever imagined in their mind for idolatry. But so Noah wakes up, says, cursed be Canaan, and he gives a lot of insight into what's going to happen. He'll be a servant of servants unto his brethren, meaning that he will fight and kick and poke and goad all of his days and try all that he possibly can to rise up above his brethren or above these other people. But as a result of who he is and what he's done and the lack of desire he's going to have to serve God, he's always going to find himself underfoot. Blessed be the Lord God of Shem, meaning that we know Shem, out of all three of these brothers, is the one who has the better relationship with God. And Canaan shall be his servant. God shall enlarge Japheth. Japheth is kind of neither here nor there. He's not bad, but he's not really great either. Then he shall dwell in the tents of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. And after all of this happens, we just kind of wrap up the life of Noah. 350 years, he dies at 950 years old. There's not a whole lot to the rest of Noah's life. He has his obedience, his faith in God. He builds the ark, gets off the ark. We have this big, huge black eye shiner moment for him. This sin that occurs with his son. And then we kind of begin to see the stage for the world getting set up on the basis of, okay, this is what these three sons are going to do. Now, next week, we are still going to talk about this curse servant thing that happens here at the end of chapter 9 going into chapter 10, because in chapter 10 we're going to have a huge long list of this is this son and these are his kids and these are the places where they went, this is this kid and these are his kids and this is the places where they are, and then this kid and so on and so forth through all three sons. But we are going to talk on a much deeper level. We're going to pull this prophecy given by Noah about these sons and what's going to happen with these three bloodlines. And we are going to talk about where all they went, what all that encompassed. We're going to put some old myths to bed on this discussion, some things that have been said about this chapter that are not entirely true. Okay. And then we are also going to cover kind of the basis for how the world would have looked after the flood and what we can ascertain from all of these places about what the post-flood world looked like. So, chapter 9. What is it, though, that applies to you? That's the last part of our show every time. First of all, you should know the word of God. God, right off the bat, coming off the ark, he gives his commandments, his guidelines, his rules, the beginnings of law to Noah. If you call yourself a child of God and you have not gone through the entire Bible, shame, shame, shame on you. You cannot know what God's will is and what God wants you to do. You cannot know wrong from right. You cannot know how the world is actually black and white. There's not any gray areas with God unless you know the Word of God. It has been given to you freely to guide and better your life. Go and make sure that you know what it is you're supposed to be doing. Secondly, God has given us an amazing abundance of promises. Some that did not come with stipulations, some that did. Go and learn for yourself about these covenants. I can give you some hints. There's one with Noah. There's one with Abraham. There's one with Isaac. There's one with Jacob. There's one with Moses, okay? Go and learn those covenants. Go and learn the promises that God made to his people, okay? It gives you a good insight into the character of God. And finally, don't be up to your sinful fleshly tricks this weekend. I understand that you're a human being, you're going to sin, you're going to make mistakes. That does not mean that we do not try to do everything within our ability and God's power, backing that ability, to overcome sin in our lives. That you have been freed from sin. There is no longer an excuse for you to be sinning. You have the ability through God's power to overcome sin. If you've got a skeleton in the closet, you got a sin problem you need to deal with it this week. Don't end up in a situation like Noah and Ham at the end of chapter 9. Especially like Noah, where you've done all these great things. You've been obedient to God. You have fulfill what God wanted you to do, and then boom, right off the boat, you're already drunk, naked in your tent, you're already making problems and having sinful issues and problems that are coming into your life. Do not end up in that boat. Work hard this weekend to overcome the sin problems in your life. And as always, this has been Studies Through the Bible with Pastor Zach Ebarb. We love all of our listeners. Pray for all of you. I only have your usernames, but we still pray for you anyway. Make sure to go back, read all the first 9 chapters of Genesis. We've covered that so far. If you're new on here and you're just not listening today, you can go back. Those recordings are there. This recording will be uploaded for everybody on Monday, Central Time, 8 a.m. my time. Okay, I don't know where you guys are, but you just know Central.